Hi, Kamahana. Christina.
Hi,
Nash. Nice to meet you. Thanks for coming. So I'm kind of just glad it's a small group because you can be informal, and at any time of the presentation, just stop me if you have questions, if we have time, so I'm going to keep mine on that.
We have three speakers, so we have plenty of time.
Okay, perfect. So this project was done in New Orleans East. I'm going to give you a little bit of a background of how the Vietnamese community came to New Orleans East, and then sort of the program that we implemented. It was a lay health worker program, and we called it our prevention and early detection screening, so we nicknamed it PEDS. I just could use this.
Yeah, you can just click on that.
This is disclosure. There was no money that was questionable for use for the program. A little Vietnam in New Orleans. So during the Vietnam War in 1975, there was about 1.5 million refugees that left Vietnam. And when you think of sort of Vietnamese refugees, in America, you think California, right, is a big area where you see Vietnamese refugees, maybe Washington, D.C., and then Houston and Dallas, Texas. What people don't really are aware of is that in New Orleans East, prior to Hurricane Katrina, there were about 12,000 Vietnamese immigrants living in New Orleans East in a small community. And throughout the presentation, you're going to hear me reference Versailles, and it stands for Versailles Arms, which is the Section 8 housing that the Vietnamese refugees were sort of put in from Catholic charities. So during Hurricane Katrina, you had 8,000 were initially the number of Vietnamese refugees in 1975, and then it grew to about 10 to 12,000 in 2005. In Hurricane Katrina, 100% of the Vietnamese community sort of evacuated, but came back very quickly because of community organizing and the Catholic community there. So when this project was implemented, there were about 10,000 Vietnamese Americans. So just to give you a little bit of a background, if you see the green part, where it says Mid-City, that's sort of where French Quarter is. If you look towards the top right, where that arrow is pointing out from, that is the community that we targeted. It's Village de l'Est, and you'll see that it's a small 1.5 square mile community that is primarily Vietnamese and very Catholic based. So when you sort of think of why is it that cervical cancer, Asian American community, it's sort of a phenomenon that just started surfacing recently. There's a lot of cultural barriers to why Asian American women don't get screened and why you don't really see health statistics among Asian American disparities. One of the reasons why it's very underrepresented, you have a lot of Asian American immigrants that don't fill out their census, particularly with the Vietnamese community. There's a little bit of distrust with political government coming from Vietnam. So when we found that a lot of these Vietnamese Americans were citizens. They have their citizenship, they've been here for a while, but they just refuse to fill out their census, and they refuse to go to the doctor, and they refuse to fill out surveys because it's just, you know, it's privacy, like I don't want you to know that I'm sick. What is the government gonna do with my numbers? So it's really hard to reach out to that population in terms of addressing health disparities. Particularly with the Vietnamese women, cervical cancer rates among Vietnamese women are about 5 times greater than non-Hispanic white women. The science behind that, and Ms. Lewis Michaels, right? Correct me if I'm wrong, but we still don't know if it's due to genetics. It may be, my personal thinking is that it's a cultural barrier. Vietnamese women, as you can see in the next bullet point, they're least likely, or maybe even not as likely, to get pap smears. There's a worldview among the Vietnamese community that a Vietnamese woman only opens her legs for her husband. Like, why do I need to open my legs for the doctor? Like, I'm not going to bed with him. I'm faithful to my husband. So you have resistance with getting pap smears. And because we were working in the Vietnamese community in New Orleans East, it's very faith-oriented. So you have huge Catholic community and a small Buddhist community, but in both faith communities, family planning and sexual health are really discussed. So this program, we were sort of feeling like we were treading on eggshells, like we want to address cervical cancer, but we know sex is going to come up, we know condom use is going to come up, so how do we sort of target this and sort of glide past the sexual part of it and go to the reproductive health part of it? So this is just a quick model of how we implemented the program. It was a Lighthouse Worker Education model, and with funding from OCAPICA, which is out of California, which stands for the Orange County Asian Pacific Islander Community Associations. They granted us $40,000 to do this project, so I just want to say thank you on record. We hired a project coordinator, and that project coordinator was responsible for identifying a Lighthouse Worker Coordinator. And this person, primarily we were looking for a woman because you're dealing with women's reproductive issues. And this particular individual should be somebody that's sort of has respect in the community, that has sort of is a community stakeholder. She holds the key to the community. She's somewhat of a community leader and people respect her. So she has some sort of value or credence to be running this program. Under her, she was responsible for identifying four individual Lighthouse workers, and these women ranged in ages. The youngest at the time was 22, and the oldest at the time was about, I think, like 60. So we had four Lighthouse workers, and each Lighthouse worker was responsible for identifying 15 individual women herself. So we did this program before I knew anything about biostats, so now I know that 60, the sample size is not sufficient for statistical significance. So I apologize, because we just were going back in the numbers. I'm like, okay, we may have to do this pilot program again with a bigger sample size. So we, in the end, reached out to 60 Vietnamese American women in the community. And the study design was, we split them into two groups. It was a randomized. So we had a hat, literally old school, no computer, we had a hat, and we had 60 names, and I would go intervention, control. So we had 30 women in the intervention group and 30 women in the control group. The intervention group women received education regarding cervical cancer and pap smear screenings. What is cervical cancer? What is HPV? What is a pap smear? What are the tools used for a pap smear? And the intervention group women also received Lighthouse Worker sessions or small group education sessions. So they would come in twice during the program. The first meeting, they would take a survey before we even talked about cervical cancer. They sat down and we handed them a survey. They took the survey and then we collected it, and then we talked for about 2 hours about cervical cancer. What do you know about cervical cancer? What do you want to know? And we used a flip chart. As you can see on the table in the middle, that flip chart was all in Vietnamese. So that was to relate to the older generation of women. In our control group, we didn't touch them. We called them once to say, can you fill out a survey and give it back to us in 5 days? And so because we lived in a very small community, we literally went and dropped off their survey in their mailboxes, and 5 days later we picked them up. We didn't remind them about getting a pap smear. We didn't do anything. We just sort of left. They were sort of our placebo baseline group. So a quick timeline, the program began in October 2008 and ended a year later. So I'm not gonna go through every part of it, but you know, recruitment, we had our sessions between March and April for our intervention group. And then due to sort of bioethics, our consultants suggested that we do a delayed intervention for our control group. So the same focus groups were done for our control group later on in August 2009. A little bit of a background of our study demographics. In the control group, which is the green bar, the control group had more women between ages 18 and 30. And I'm going to ask you to keep that in mind, because that's going to play out in our results. In the intervention group, we had more women ages 40 to 50, so an older demographic in our intervention group. In terms of language proficiency, we had about a little bit less than half of each women in our intervention group were fluent in English, but obviously in the control group, which is the green, we had more fluent speakers in our control group, and that, I'm assuming, tied into the age of 18 to 30 in our group. Sorry, my head's in the way. And finally, religion. So almost 100% of our intervention and our control group were consisted of women with Catholic background. Very small percent were Buddhist, and some refused not to answer what religion they were. So this goes into our findings. So our pre-training, which is before We compared the statistics with implementing our small group sessions. We found that 28% of women in the intervention group never heard of a pap smear before the training. So these answers were collected from the surveys that we handed out before the sessions. 47% of the women, however, in the intervention group have received pap smear. So that statistic was sort of encouraging for us. Not quite over 50%, but at least almost 50% were aware and received pap smears. The last bullet point could be confusing, but I'm going to go through it. 90% of women could point out that there's an association between HPV and cervical cancer. So a lot of people see this presentation, they're saying 19% of women had HPV, they had the human papillomavirus. I'm like, no. The others said that there's an association between HPV and cervical cancer. In our control group, 21% of women never heard of pap smears. But however, 58% of women did receive pap smears. So again, I'm assuming that this has to do with the age of women that were primarily making up our control group. And then 42%, which is also a bigger percentage difference from our intervention group, 42% of women knew that there was an association between the human papillomavirus and cervical cancer. And that's just what I've been drilling. I don't want to sound like a broken record. So post-training, which is after we implemented these group sessions through the one-year program, there was a percent increase. 36% more women, upon receiving the education sessions, went and scheduled pap smears. 89% of women, so you have another percent increase, knew that there was an association between HPV and cervical cancer. So we found that these training sessions were helpful. And how we scheduled or sort of modeled the training sessions, what really played in our favor was the organization that I work for, the logos on the bottom, the Mary Queen of Vietnam Community Development Corporation. We had a relationship with Tulane School of Medicine, and we opened a small clinic called Tulane Community Health Clinic. And it was right in front of our office. So we literally had the small group sessions in the back in our office, and we would ask the women in the intervention group, do you want to schedule a pap smear now? And they would say, yeah. So we would just walk them to the front. So it literally was a very organic, it was a little bit of a hand-holding because a lot of these women were uncomfortable talking about their sexual health. So it took more of a nudge, but we were okay with it because that was our job. So it really helped in our favor after these sessions, walking them to the front, making an appointment for them, and then calling them to remind them a week ahead, you know, Mrs. Fu, your appointment is on Thursday, and they would show up. The last statistic, 10%, there was a 10% increase of women who believed that getting cervical cancer was God's will. So in our survey, we had a question that, what do you believe causes cervical cancer? Is it HPV? Is it being sexually promiscuous? Is it smoking, or is it God's will? And it was interesting because after our trainings, after we talked about HPV and talked about not getting pap smears, we had a 10% increase of women believing that it was still God's will and had nothing to do with the virus. So that was just a little piece of interesting information. In our control group, so this is after our delayed intervention program that we implemented for our control group, 10% more women received pap smears. 46% of women requested pap smear appointments after the delayed intervention. So when we just handed them the surveys and they gave it back to us, barely anyone, right, scheduled a pap smear appointment. After we implemented the delayed intervention program, they would call us back and like, oh, okay, can you schedule me an appointment, please? I never had a pap smear before. I'm 36. I'm really worried. So it's like, no problem. And we liked that. We wanted to see that sort of change in behavioral health. And I left the organization in June of 2010. At the time of when I was putting this presentation together, it was the beginning, early 2010. At that time, we were still having women scheduling pap appointments, which is very encouraging. 85, so a huge number of our participants were Catholic. So our study results showed that because it was a religious community, there was a very strong and special association to faith. And we found that a lot resonating through our older participants. Because it was, and I do sound like a broken record, but we were in a Catholic community, and I would notice when I was giving those sessions and we talked about the virus, they would still say, but if God wants you to have cervical cancer, you're going to have cervical cancer. So what's the point? I mean, yeah, I'll get a screening, but if it's His will, who am I to fight it? So I think integrating that into our future behavioral health intervention programs is definitely very, very important. Social networking was just insane in the intervention group. When that map that I showed at the beginning with the web, the first week that we hired on our lay health workers, I remember one of the lay health workers said, I only have 6 women, I can't make 15. Like, even though they were from the community and, you know, they had family members and friends, it was just hard to be like, do you want to be in a cervical cancer study? The next week, the same lay health worker that only said she had 6 said, forget it, I have like 20 now, who wants my women? Because what had happened was these women would talk to each other in the markets or in the farmers markets or at church and say, you know, there's a program about, they called it the vagina program in the community. They said, and you get paid, because it was an incentivized program. So every time a woman came to a focus group, we would give her $15. And she's like, yeah, you go, you talk about your vagina, you get paid. Let's join the program. So in the end, we actually had to turn people away, which was a huge disadvantage. But because we'd only had enough funding to reach out to 60 women, that web of connection played a huge role in reaching out to our participants. We also found that within our intervention group, the women were definitely more comfortable talking about their sexual health outside of the training sessions. And there's always a story that I refer to. There's this one family, and I'm changing the name for confidential purposes, but her name was Maxi, and she sort of took me in because I'm not from New Orleans, so she was my surrogate mother for 2 years. And I remember one evening after the program, we were midway through the program, and her sister-in-law, which is Gobing, was chopping cucumbers for dinner. And, you know, you're in a culturally traditional community, so the men are actually watching TV, drinking beer, the women are in the kitchen cooking. And Maxi goes, hey, Gobing, did you hear about Christina's vagina program? And Gobing's like, yeah, I actually have to get my vagina checked. It's time. It's my year. And Gobing's husband drops the remote, and he's like, vagina? Why? Who's pregnant? Who's pregnant? And Gobing's like, this is women's issues. Just be quiet. Just watch your TV. And a year ago, you would never even talk about sexual health at home, in public, anywhere. But to see this sort of cultural shift and a social shift and women being more empowered and being advocates of their health and like shushing their husbands. Like, he's like, don't talk about your vagina. And she's like, I talk about what I want. And it was great. I thought it was amazing. And we also found that there was a willingness to participate in future studies in both groups. So we had women in both the control and the intervention group saying, if you're doing a program on diabetes, call me. If you're doing a program on mental health, call me. So this pilot program was small, but it definitely paved the way for future programs that we definitely want to implement. So in conclusion, the lay health worker education model is very feasible and very applicable of a method to use in the Vietnamese community, especially with Vietnamese women. We also found that during these sessions, they just wanted to talk, especially living through something like Hurricane Katrina and now the oil spill. Creating a safe space for women to just sit and, yeah, we can talk about sexual health, but it's sort of catapulted after an hour and 15 minutes to other issues. It may not be relevant to sexual health, but it's definitely a healthy venue for women. And this program definitely addresses health awareness. It creates sort of a different form of knowledge, not so much a worldview within the Vietnamese culture, but a worldview backed up by scientific knowledge, which we find is very important to implementing programs. Implemented behavioral change, as you can tell, with a lot of women now wanting to get pap smears, and it allowed women to become advocates for their own health, like that example of Lexi and Gobing making dinner in their home. As of June 2010, the PEDS program successfully screened 56 out of the 60 women in the study sample, which I think is a big win. So for next steps with the program, we are encouraging part 2 of the program, which is each woman bring in at least one more participant to get screened. hopefully with some more funding, we can also incentivize the program, but right now it's more of a word of mouth. And we do find that happening where a lot of the women in the intervention program are saying, yeah, I brought my cousin, and she got screened at Tulane Community Health Clinic thanks to your program. Do you have $15 for her? And I'm like, no, we don't, but if we do, we'll definitely let you know. And we find that social networking, like I mentioned before, is definitely beneficial for future health initiatives. So we hope that we can apply this model to different health initiatives. We're doing a diabetes screening study right now, following the same model. So it's with both men and women. So we followed, you know, the same sort of networking map, and it's definitely worked very well. So this is just the staff. The four lay health workers are below. The youngest is 22, which was me. And then the woman on the far right in the yellow, she was a 60-year-old. So you had your ages sort of covered. And then Ziem was the project coordinator, who's now the executive director of our organization. So thank you for paying attention.